about it is that, and I think this is the whole part of the whole issue around the continuance of slavery throughout the world, but then throughout the United States, is that there was lots of opposition to slavery in the United States and elsewhere, on moral grounds, that this was not could not be morally justified. But at the same time, people were, even if they kind of acknowledged that in the way that George Washington did, they weren't prepared to give up the privileges that slavery afforded them, even if they were kind of aware that it wasn't a morally legitimate activity. And you see that a lot, in many other things. I mean, we all know, climate change is happening, and that the impacts in future years could be quite dramatic and devastating. But damn, we don't want to pay that little bit of fuel tax and do something about it.
Mm. Well, I mean, supposedly about what we were talking about 6 days ago,
yeah,
some farmers in Canada are going to be hit hard by that. Mm-hmm. Thing, just so you know.
Yeah.
Okay. So this.
Anyway, did you have more on the topic of?
Oh yeah. Well, the thing is also, what the Eye of Providence, which was developed in 1782.
Yeah.
But actually, the very design that we see in the $1 bill in the United States is, mm-hmm, 1856.
Yeah.
It wasn't something in 1935. They just popped that specific design. But the idea of that thing is that they wanted the concept of the American, of what the United States was, to have a certain power to it. And the other thing is that, but the choice of the pyramid supposedly is that this is a type of architecture that had lasted the ages, and they, mm-hmm, wanted the United States, this entity, to last the ages also. And I think I mentioned this in a few other shows. It was the Masons who picked it up from the United States, not the other way around. It wasn't that this is a Mason thing. It was the other way around. The Masons picked it up. And it was sort of became, until 1935, kind of obscure, too. And that's why people see it as a Mason's thing. Now, and one thing I checked up on, mm-hmm, in the World Book Encyclopedia, which is kind of a established kind of a conservative thing, I didn't know this. This is interesting. There was a separate entity for the Masons, but for blacks. And actually, there was a lot of activity with blacks up to the 20th century that involved their group, mm, it was the Masons. So that was, yeah, a bit interesting. Mm. I hadn't known that previously.
Yeah.
But so the other thing is that even if we take away the equation of slavery and blacks, was the American Revolution really a positive approach to the common white person, mm-hmm, in the colonies? And actually, there was something. This just disappeared. Like, this is the competition. Coast to Coast AM. You heard of the show, Magnus?
Yep.
It used to be Art Bell. Now it's George Norley.
Right.
And they did something 10 years ago. I can't get any evidence of the show. But what I did on the internet, get a bit of what they were saying. And this guy wrote a book. I can't get the book. And they were, like, really challenging that for the common person, it was actually worse off after the revolutionary period. And they were saying something like, before the revolutionary period, you would come to work. You would get alcohol provided, supposedly, for you, because that was part of what was demanded of your employer, to give you this, and you took your time. And when the revolutionary thing came, well, it got a bit tighter. There was a bit kind of a more doctrine order,
mm-hmm,
but I don't, that kind of disappeared, the evidence of that show and that book. But what I did get on the internet were There was actually a black woman was talking about, would you really have joined the revolution during this period? And she went through the list of certain people that may not have been advantageous to have been involved with this. Mm-hmm. So I think it's sort of like a kind of a corny, it's even not even quite a mythology, it's sort of mysterious, like, how do you feel about it as a Canadian, Magnus? Or maybe you're a dual citizen?
I'm not. Well, you know, I remember when I was a kid, it was easy to be jealous because the Americans had created an entire mythology around their history, whether it was the Revolutionary War or the Wild West, that made all their history seem all very exciting. Because they've done a very effective job of mythologizing and creating heroes and other stuff in their history, right? Whether it's George Washington, all the way from the cutting down the apple tree and the other things about him, whatever.
Cherry tree, right. Very pedantic.
You know, and, you know, the various sort of bigger-than-life, you know, characters of the Old West and the whole story of the Old West, which then gets tied into the ideas of, you know, rugged independence and, you know, which still permeates American culture today in the sense of, you know, the rejection of government and, you know, looking out for yourself and independence and self-resilience, you know, all that kind of stuff, right? Which feeds into their sort of anti-government sort of thing, which is a big thing in the States. I mean, I think that it exists in most democracies, but it's very much a big thing. And we, you know, and by comparison, Canadian history seemed very boring and bureaucratic. But now I kind of appreciate it more because, you know, sometimes being boring and, you know, bureaucratic is as history is kind of better.
But we still have, I see John A. McDonald, supposedly there were a few scandals that's not brought up in Pierre Burton's The National Dream and The Last Spike, supposedly.
Yeah.
He did bring up one thing about John A. McDonald that, who was an alcoholic, in the House of Commons, he had a pitcher that seemed to be water, but it was of gin. And that was this. I'm 61. In the 1970s, you can finally get this online. It was on TV every week, The National Dream, which was really the two books, The National Dream and The Last Spike.
Yep.
And it was sort of interesting to see. But I was talking about this with somebody about a week ago, and they said, well, who hadn't seen it, but he was saying that there were certain scandals with John A. McDonald's government that's probably not brought up, what I saw.
Well, I have read, and I don't know a lot about it, but it's certainly not something that got covered in history class in school. It was that apparently the early elections in Canada, the parliamentary elections, were scandalously corrupt with loads of, like, everything from vote buying to ballot stuffing and a lot of other crazy stuff that would, you know, because, you know, all the different parties and, you know, whatnot were all sort of vying for power. And eventually they, you know, they cleaned it up and sort of maybe organized. But apparently, you know, a lot of those elections from between 1867 and, say, 1900, that sort of early period, there were a lot of really dodgy things going on. So, but it's, you know, we sort of papered over that part of our history.
Well, one thing that this TV show, which is from the 70s, that they did bring up was the exploitation of Chinese laborers that were brought over to Canada and the exploitation of that. So it was sort of, it seems to me that I would have to see it again, that he probably didn't talk a lot about the whole nine yards of a lot of the problem, but at least it was a bit honest. It wasn't trying to whitewash everything in that series. I decisively remember that being brought up in the docudrama that was this. It's called The National Dream. You can finally, because you know what it was? A lot of the CBC programming mm-hmm. Canadian Content, CBC, because of these union regulations, they couldn't be shown. They couldn't. They couldn't show. And now you can. They did some legality about it, yep. But it was a blocking of showing you beachcombers, which is not all that bad of a situation. But it, all the same, because it was, they said, well, we have to pay every cameraman to show broadcast it again or something. And so, but now it's back. You can see it on the internet.
All right. I'm sure a lot of this stuff is available on the CBC's online service. So.
Well, no, yeah, it is now, but it was about 20 years ago, there was an article in the Globe and Mail why the beachcombers aren't on after school.
Right. There you go. You can go searching for the last, no, the National Dream.
The National Dream, because it's based on the two books, The National Dream and The Last Spike, but the TV show was The National Dream.
All right. Let's get to some music. This is Tiga and Hudson Mohawk, Exit Warehouse at Dawn. Was Tiga and Hudson Mohawk, Exit Warehouse at Dawn. I guess that's some post-rave music to go get your coffee to. Next up, this is Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. Lots of people feel refreshed after a 3-day weekend. How about having one every week? Almost 200 companies around the world have completed 6-month trials of a 4-day work week, with no reductions in employee pay. So far, the results are promising.
Stress, burnout, mental health, physical health, job satisfaction, all of those going in the right directions.
Juliet Shore is an economist and sociologist at Boston College and is leading the trials in collaboration with the nonprofit 4-Day Week Global. Their results suggest that the shorter work week has also had modest climate benefits. On average, participants spent a little less time commuting by car, and many reported that they spent more time on climate-friendly activities, such as biking and walking, instead of driving. Most companies have been able to implement the changes without sacrificing productivity. But Shore says other studies she's done suggest that working less while also rethinking our cultural drive to produce so much could yield larger reductions in carbon pollution.
We get a climate benefit and people get a well-being benefit. So I'd like to see work time reduction in the climate discourse in a much bigger way than it has been.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
I wouldn't mind a 4-day week.
I live off in the actual estate. Me and my brother sold the family house, so we're not. I
work. You're retired?
Well, from, yeah, anyway, it's.
It'd be interesting to get someone on the program here to talk more about the idea of a 4-day week, because it's easy to appreciate the benefits of more time off and less commute times and people not having to, you know.
Well, the technocrats talked about a 25-hour work week, just to bring up what I brought up a few weeks ago. I mean, so it's been around these things. So 4 times 8 is 32.
Right.
So they're off by about 7 hours.
Yeah. I mean, of course, the other part of it is it's nice to have more time off. But, you know, if you're working 4 days a week instead of 5 days a week, and presumably you're getting less accomplished. Although sometimes I've heard that people, that doesn't really happen because, well, I won't get, for whatever reasons, people are more energy at work or whatever. But it'd be interesting to hear someone talk about that in more detail.
Well, they used to talk about every automation will take over everything. That was like the what the future was supposed to be ages ago.
And now we have AI coming down, where I saw a headline, I didn't have a chance to read the article, that, you know, some Larry Summers, who's like in the States, he's was like a relatively famous economist and was, you know, served cabinet positions that got, anyway, you know, he was saying, you know, AI could completely eliminate labor as we know it.
Well, how are you going to have like a janitor thing with AI? You're not going to, I mean, no, quite seriously, there are certain things that I think they still haven't been able to maneuver a mop or whatever. I mean, in some cases, maybe they have, but like picking berries, is that going to be automated one of these days? Or
yep. Yeah, I know. It's sort of interesting. You know, we could see, you know, I mean, in terms of the 4-day work week, you know, we could see a lot of, you know, if there's a lot of types of jobs eliminated, you know, one of the ways of having a 4-day week means more people would be hired to fill all those things. Anyway.
Well, the Jetsons, the original incarnations, 1962 to 63, George Jetson works, I think, 3 or 2 hours a day and still complains about it, supposedly. That was the gag.
Of course. All right.
Yeah.
We have a final little segment here before we finish up the show entirely. Coming up at noon coming up in about 11 minutes is Democracy Now!, so stay tuned for that. Wandering Rhythms at noon and up at 3 p.m. typically Tuesday, and a lot more great programming coming up here on CJSF. We'll be back before it's done. This is a quick little segment from Ian Fleming's. He is, of course, famous as the author of the James Bond series. This is from a series called The Spoken Word, British Writers on the BBC. And I hope you enjoy this. Ian Fleming.
Mr. Fleming, where were you born?
I was born in London.
You went to Eton. I believe your main distinction there was in athletics.
Yes, it was. I'm afraid I wasn't terribly good at my books.
Victor Ludorum twice and public schools hurdles. And then Sandhurst?
Yes, I went to Sandhurst with the idea of going into the army and into the Black Watch, incidentally. But then it was decided to mechanize the army, and me and a lot of my friends decided we didn't want to be what we thought then would be large-scale garage mechanics.
So?
So I had a go at the diplomatic and learned my languages for it, and I passed in seventh, but there were only five vacancies, and so I decided not to have another go, but to go straight in and start earning some money. So I joined Reuters, which was the nearest thing to the diplomatic in a way, because I could use my languages, German and French and Russian. And I had a wonderful time in Reuters, was a correspondent in Moscow and Berlin and all over the place. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I learnt there the sort of good straightforward, or at any rate, straightforward writing style that everybody wants to have if they're going to write books.
How long did you stay with them?
I stayed with them for 3 years. But then I wanted to earn some more money, and Reuters weren't very keen on paying large sums in those days. No doubt they're much better now. And so I went into the city. Mm-hmm. But I didn't get on very well there because I'm not very good at making money as such.
How do you mean?
Well, I mean, just pure making money. I must do something that entertains me. If it makes money at the same time, well, that's all the better for me.
Yes. Well, then the war came along and you joined the Royal Navy. You became personal assistant to the Director of Naval Intelligence. Well, this led, not surprisingly, to some rather violent action, I believe.
Well, not so much that, really. It was a very interesting life. I took part in the Dieppe raid, which was a very bloody affair, and I had some exciting adventures around the world, and altogether I had an extremely... I couldn't have had a more interesting war, if I can have an interesting war.
And presumably your naval intelligence experience provided some useful source material for your later books.
Yes, it taught one what one could say in writing thrillers and what one couldn't say, and of course it taught you really how the intelligence machine does work. I can't say that, of course, I tell that exactly in my books because they're fiction and the whole thing is much larger than life. Mm-hmm. But as I said, at least it tells you what mistakes not to make.
And when the war ended?
Then I went to the Sunday Times, to the Kemsley newspapers, and I became their foreign manager. They didn't have a foreign department in those days. And it was my job to place correspondents all around the world and look after their welfare and see that they wrote plenty of intelligent stuff.
Yes. Now, your books. You've written now, 11 James Bond books?
Well, there's actually 12 because the next one has just gone to my publishers.
Yes. There's one a year?
There's one a year.
So the first one then, 1950?
52, written in 51, I suppose, yes.
Had you had this character growing in mind for a long time?
No, I can't say I had, really. He sort of developed when I was just on the edge of getting married, and I was frenzied at the prospect of this great step in my life after having been a bachelor for so long. And I really wanted to take my mind off the agony. And so I decided to sit down and write a book.
Yes. Is Bond based on any particular person or combination of persons?
No, not really. He's a sort of fictional mixture of commandos and Secret Service agents that I met during the war, but of course entirely fictionalized.
Yes. Is there much of you in it?
I hope not. I mean, people do connect me with James Bond simply because I happen to like scrambled eggs and short-sleeved shirts and some of the things that James Bond does, yes. But I certainly haven't got his guts nor his very lively appetites.
Now, the first James Bond book was an immediate success.
Yes, it was.
How long do these books take you to write?
6 weeks to 2 months, the actual writing, but I never correct as I go along. I try and get pace into the narrative by sitting straight down at the typewriter. But then, of course, I do 2 or 3 months correction afterwards, and then one has to correct the proofs and so on, so yes. It takes about a year altogether, let's say.
Are you a systematic worker? Can you work so many hours a day regularly?
Yes, I find I have to. I work for about 3 hours in the morning and 1 hour in the evening, and I find unless I stick to a routine, if I just wait for genius to arrive from the skies, it just doesn't arrive. I just get on with the work.
You write these books always at your vacation home in Jamaica.
Yes.
Do you look forward to writing a new one every year?
Well, I don't really, unless I've got it firmly fixed in my mind. And, of course, this is a very bad period for me this time of the year because I'm trying to work out the next adventure of James Bond, which has got to be written in January and February. And I'm always rather in despair, thinking I'm not going to have enough book to write.
Yes. There's been a cumulative rise in sales and success since the first book.
I think there has, with the exception of the last one, which was, let's say last year's one, which was The Spy Who Loved Me, where I tried to break away from my normal formula, but the readers were so furious that James Bond didn't appear until about three quarters of the way through, and that it was written ostensibly by a girl.
In the first person?
In the first person. That I must confess that it wasn't a success, and it took quite a beating from the critics.
And now the books are being made into films?
Yes, they've made Dr. No already, and it's been a tremendous success in England, and even more of a success, I think, in America, where it's opened several weeks ago, where it's breaking records. They're now doing From Russia with Love, and I went out to see them in Istanbul, see the unit at work, and I was tremendously impressed with the casting and the way the script had been written, and I think it's going to be an equal success.
They're going to do the whole James Bond character?
They've got an option on doing all the books, yes, one after another.
11 bestsellers in 11 years, and very profitable film sales. Now, on the face of it, that looks like unmixed success, but some of the press notices haven't been all that glowing. They've accused you of being sadistic and too much sex. Taking the charge of sadism first, your torture scenes are pretty beastly in some of the books.
Well, I don't know how many of you read, but of course they're nothing to what they really are in real life. And I think the old days of the hero getting a crack over the head with a cricket stump have rather gone out. I mean, we all have become considerably wiser since the last war. And I've tried to bring verisimilitude into these books, and it's certainly true that the critics have occasionally found them pretty strong meat.
Yes. What effect do you think these scenes have on the average reader? Are they going to give him unhealthy ideas, or is this vicarious violence a harmless way of sublimating aggressive tendencies?
Well, I think that's a way of putting it, but I was brought up on what we used to call fourpenny horrors, and I can't remember that any of the excitements ever did me any harm. All history is sex and violence, and I think it's ridiculous to go on writing thrillers in the old Bulldog Drummond, John Buchan way when life has come so fast past us.
Yes, well, sex. Bond takes his sex where he finds it almost as casually as he takes a drink.
Well, he has one girl per book, approximately, and that's one a year. I think that's he's a bachelor. And he moves around the world pretty rapidly, and I don't see any great harm in that myself.
No, he's unusually fortunate in meeting these lovely and cooperative girls.
Yes, I envy him.
All your books, Mr. Fleming, show tremendous attention to detail. You've obviously done a great deal of background research. Have you ever slipped up at all in any of the James Bond books?
Yes, I'm afraid I do from time to time. I take a lot of trouble not to, but inevitably things slip past me and past my publishers. And, for instance, in the last book, the girl goes into the bar in the casino and orders half a bottle of Paul Roger champagne. Well, it turns out that the Paul Roger is the one champagne firm that doesn't turn out half bottles. And, again, some kind friend commented on the fact that when Bond drives up to his headquarters in Regent's Park and smells the smell of burning leaves and realizes the summer has come to an end, I was making a mistake because the Regent's Park is now a smokeless zone. Well, that is very helpful. But I find that the other people make mistakes. Shakespeare, for instance, had clocks chiming in ancient Rome. And
yes, and somebody also writes and tells them.
Yes, it's very helpful of them, and I try and correct them in the later editions.
How much longer do you think you can keep on going? Is he a job for life?
Well, I don't know. It just depends on how much more I can go on following his adventures.
You don't feel that he's keeping you from more serious writing?
No, I'm not in the Shakespeare stakes. I've got no ambitions.
That was an interview with James Bond creator Ian Fleming, recorded for the BBC in 1963, talking about his most famous creation, James Bond. I love that little story at the end there about the little factual mistakes. They're burning leaves in London, but then it's a smoke-free zone.
He would die in 1 year's time, by the way. He died in 1964.
Yeah. That was So very close to the end of his career. All right. Well, we got 10 seconds left. So
10.
We're out of time here. Yeah. Stay tuned for Democracy Now. We'll be back next Monday. What are you talking about? Very quickly.
Harvest of Shame. It's a dog.